It's time for Security Now with Steve Gibson. We've got Drupal issues, yes, again. We've got key fob hacks, yes, again. We also will talk a little bit about why you should probably not buy that cheap knockoff video doorbell. It's all coming up next on Security Now. Security Now comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company does not have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 795, recorded Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. DNS consolidation. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Stop letting people keep logs of what you do online. Protect your privacy with one click. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/securitynow. And by LastPass. Don't wait until the end of the year to get strong security. Start solidifying your cybersecurity strategy with the award-winning LastPass right now. Go to lastpass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. And by Worldwide Technology and Fortinet. When was the last time your company updated your security strategy? Are your business assets protected? WWT offers security solutions and services that will protect every endpoint of your business and help you combat the next-gen threats. Visit WWT.com/twit to get started. It's time for Security Now, the show that covers your privacy and security online. It does a little teaching, too, and have some fun while we're at it. And that's the guy in charge right over my shoulder here, Mr. Steve Gibson of the GRC.com
site. I suppose that depends upon your definition of fun.
If you listen to this show, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think it's fun to write in assembly language, you've come to the right place.
So, actually, I have a little bit of news about that, too. Alan Malventano and I have been exchanging some mail.
He's the king.
With some potentially really interesting news about consequences for Spinrite. We'll get to that in a minute. We're going to end up talking about an interesting research paper, which was recently presented at one of the many ACM, Association for Computing Machinery conferences, about DNS consolidation and what has happened over the last few years, what the stats are, and what it means for the internet in general, and for how important you feel it is to keep your website online, whether it's an enterprise or a personal site or whatever. But lots of stuff has happened. We've got a couple of new and forthcoming Chrome features. I'm going to quickly run through some new and notable ransomware casualties, including a couple of follow-ups on previous events. We'll look at a critical flaw in Drupal's CMS, their content management system. There's a critical need for anybody who hasn't updated recently. We've got the big trouble with generic smart doorbells. The NCC group took a look at 11 of them, and what they found was just chilling, but shouldn't surprise us. We have a little takeaway from that. We've also got the interesting attack, the third actually by this developer, on Tesla's Model X key fobs. We have certificate authorities' adaptation to single-year browser certs, which we were anticipating. I got a note this morning from DigiCert. Maybe it was yesterday morning. Anyway, we've got several instances of leaked credential archives and what they mean, a critical remote code execution vulnerability in a major MDM server platform, mobile device management. I have a bit of commentary on the Salvation Trilogy. Not to any spoilers, of course, but I'm at 92%, and oh, Leo. Also, some extremely promising news about SpinRite's future as a consequence of something that the benchmark has been revealing. And then we're going to wrap up by taking a look at the consequences of the increasing consolidation of DNS service providers and what it means. And, of course, we've got a fun picture of the week, as we always try to have.
You have been very busy, haven't you?
Yeah.
Working hard, as always, on Security Now. All right, well, let's take a little break, and then we'll get to the picture of the week. Our show today brought to you by the best VPN in all the world, at least the one I use, ExpressVPN. And actually, I think I can say that with some confidence. ExpressVPN is all about privacy. It's all about security. And there's even a fun side to it. It's all about watching all those Doctor Who episodes on Netflix UK or all the anime you could eat on Netflix Japan. ExpressVPN is a VPN. We've talked about these. If you're watching this show, I don't need to explain a VPN to you, virtual private network. You might be saying, well, I don't go to coffee shops much these days, so do I really need a VPN? And actually, the problem that happens at coffee shops is to some degree also a problem at home. I'm not talking about the guy in the hoodie sitting in the corner trying to snarf your traffic. I'm talking about the privacy implications. When you're at a coffee shop using the internet, whoever is running that at router sees everything you do, what sites you go to, what searches you make. So does their internet service provider. And I should point out, the law completely allows an ISP to record your visits, your traffic, your DNS lookups, and then sell them on to a third party. And I think many ISPs do that. Some ISPs even inject more ads into your traffic through essentially what I would call a man-in-the-middle attack. I mean, it is kind of a nasty place out there. If you're using a VPN, you're completely shutting down the coffee shop owner or your internet service provider or your mobile carrier. They can't see what you're doing. They just see that you're using a VPN and there's an encrypted tunnel. But I think it's important to point out that you're really just kicking the can down the road, because the same thing the ISP or the coffee shop owner could do, that VPN can do. You want to choose a VPN that has I'll give you a couple of attributes you absolutely have to look for. And Steve said this many times. Number one, zero logging. You know, they see what you're doing, but they must not record it, make it available to anybody. It's your privacy that's at stake here. Of course, a lot of inexpensive or free VPNs are incented not to do that. That's why there is kind of a little pall over the whole VPN industry, because some of these guys really aren't very good. But they also need to be secure, using a secure technology, locked down, doing it right. And of course, they need to be fast, because you don't want a performance penalty, because you're hopping through this server. And ExpressVPN is all three. So, and it's fast enough that you can watch streaming HD video and enjoy it. In fact, it's so fast, I know a lot of people who put ExpressVPN on their router. Yes, there's a version for routers. So that way, not only is all your traffic in the house secured, even your IoT traffic, you don't even notice the speed hit. It's just transparent to you. I love ExpressVPN. And ExpressVPN, you know, they've got a privacy policy. You should read it. That's just right. They use this trusted server technology that is RAM only, cannot write. It's sandbox, cannot write to the drive. So even if somebody wanted to, they couldn't in any way record your visit. And when you close your VPN session, poof, it's gone. RAM is emptied. There is no trace of your visit. And they've validated both the privacy policies and the trusted server technology using a PricewaterhouseCooper, very trusted auditors who've come in, examined it, and they've said, yes, absolutely, this works as advertised. You know, there's another way we know. Law enforcement in some countries doesn't use warrants. They just come barging in. They take the servers. And in every case, and it's been in the news, you do a Google search, when law enforcement takes ExpressVPN servers, there's nothing on them they can use. No information at all. So not only do they not give information to marketers, they don't give information to anybody. I want you to try it out. Number one rated by CNET, by Wired. It's the only VPN I'd use to protect my online activity. We've got a good deal for you. And as I said, it's not free. You pay about $7 a month. Well worth it. But you don't want a VPN you don't pay for. ExpressVPN.com/security now, because you're going to pay one way or the other. So let's do it up front, all right? ExpressVPN.com/security now. You buy a one-year package. You get 3 extra months free. That's basically a 25% discount. E-X-P-R-E-S-S. Spell it out. ExpressVPN.com/security now. We thank them for their support of Security Now and our entire network. And I thank you for supporting Security Now. It's very important you use that address so they know you saw it here. ExpressVPN.com/security now. And now to Steve Gibson and the picture of the week, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so we have this picture of the week is a chart which shows a sort of, it's two-axis chart where we have rows of time to crack a password, where we go from 4 characters up to 18 characters. And then in columns of each of those rows is the complexity of the password at that length. So a password that had numbers only, that had lowercase letters only, upper and lowercase letters, numbers, upper and lowercase letters, or finally numbers, upper and lowercase letters, and symbols. And so 5 different classes of password complexity on one axis and password length on the other. So what you get is an interesting diagram, such that obviously in the upper left, where it was four numeric password only, that's going to be instantly cracked.
Even if it's a mix of upper and lower case and numbers and symbols, 4 is just too few.
Right, exactly. And then in the exact opposite corner, I don't even know what 7QD, what that quadrillion, probably 7 wow. quadrillion years, which, you know, is probably sufficient.
And that's not even that long a password. That's 18 characters. That's not even that long.
Yeah.
I do much longer.
But with upper, lower case, and we're assuming it's not words, you know, it's random. But anyway, so this is no revelation to any of our listeners, but it's such a good chart that it's already, since I posted the show notes up on Twitter, I've seen it being retweeted. That is this particular chart. I went to its source, howsecureismypassword.net, and they've got something actually that kind of copies the password haystacks concept, where as you're putting in a password, it's showing you how long, although it doesn't show you all the, you know, all the fun stuff that haystacks does. But anyway, my point is that this chart would be good for our listeners to share with people who are unaware of like what it means. Because, you know, for example, you could like look up your password. Okay, mine is 10 characters and I've got upper and lowercase characters only. Well, this says a month. Now, of course, there's a whole bunch of assumptions that are required. We know all that. But just to get the concept through, I thought this was a really nice presentation. So I wanted to share it with our listeners.
How recent is this? Is this modern computers? And do we worry even about quantum computing? Like suddenly all of this stuff is, you know, takes seconds because of a quantum computer?
Well, so there's a perfect example of all the things that are unstated. For example, is this brute forcing over the internet trying to get into an account? Is it an offline hack where you're able to run like, you know, employ GPUs that are, or even more, Bitcoin hardware acceleration in order to do SHA 256 at ridiculous speeds? I mean, so this is meant to convey the concept of both complexity and length are factors, and, you know, to sort of give people a rule of thumb. I mean, and frankly, you know, my haystacks page is the same way. It sort, right. sort of is meant to give you a sense of like, you know, longer is better, more complicated is better. So do that. Okay, so Chrome's Omnibox is becoming more Omni. And we were talking just before you hit the record button on the podcast, Leo, about something that required Chrome in order to work. I'm a Chrome user. Like, for example, the show notes are composed every week in Google Docs. And I just figure, why is might as well do that in Chrome? Because it's going to definitely like itself.
Right.
So Firefox is open statically to my left. And that's where my hundreds of tabs tend to, accrue over time. Chrome, I sort of fire up just because it's convenient. So from time to time. But so there was an interesting little blurb that I saw that Chrome was adding, which I think would appeal to our users. If you and what that is the ability to put commands like UI related commands into the Omnibox, which is what they call the URL field. The point being, you can put like search terms in or URLs or whatever, and the browser will try, not always perfectly, by the way, sometimes it annoys me, but generally try to figure out what you're asking and do the right thing. But how cool would it be if you could type in clear cache or delete history or wipe cookies or update browser or incognito or edit passwords or edit credit card or translate this page? That's coming. It's not turned on yet. It's being rolled out slowly over time, but anybody who wants to can turn it on today. If you put in the Omnibox Chrome:// flags, that will bring you to the big repository of switches. And you then need to search on that page. There is a search field at the top. Put in Omnibox, O-M-N-I-B-O-X, space suggestion. That will reduce the huge number of options to 3. The first 2 are what you need to enable. Omnibox suggestion button row, enable that. And normally it's set to default, which means that Chrome or Google will eventually flip that on for you when they decide everybody wants this. And then the second one, I don't know why it's called Pedal, but it's Omnibox Pedal Suggestions, P-E-D-A-L. Now, you see this sometimes where programmers come up with some strange term and it survives, the UI and it ends up surfacing for some reason. Anyway, Omnibox Pedal Suggestions and Omnibox suggestion button row. Enable them both. Then in the lower right, you'll see that you've been presented with a relaunch button. So click that. When it comes back up, you can type things in to the Omnibox command, like wipe cookies, delete history, clear cache, and so forth, which is just kind of a cool feature. It's worth noting that Chrome is not the first browser on the block to do this. In fact, Firefox has had this since the spring of this year, but it's not as obvious there. I think the Mozilla people, being a little more conservative, were afraid that if you put in clear cache, that might not be what a Firefox user wanted. Google doesn't seem to worry about that. You have to say clear Firefox cache in order for it to present you with a button. What happens when you issue a command, or in the case of Chrome, something that it thinks is sufficiently clear that you're talking to it, is that the upper suggestion in the little drop-down list of things that you might be asking becomes a button, which you can then click in order to immediately have that action take effect. So anyway, just a cool thing. As I said, Firefox, you got to add the word Firefox to like get its attention, but also it tends then to false positive less often. So anyway, just a cool little feature. Also, and this might be relevant to people who use Chrome with a gazillion tabs. I don't know how you can when tabs are like stuck in a horizontal row. I have a gazillion because tabs themselves are horizontal, so stacking them vertically is the only thing that makes sense. And someday the world is going to figure that out, but that's okay. There is now another forthcoming feature for Chrome where you can enable a tab search feature to have Chrome search for text, do an incremental search on the text of all the tabs you have open. So I think this sort of signifies that we're reaching that point in browser development where we've run out of good ideas or things that we really need. And so now they're sitting around scratching their butt thinking, okay, you know, we don't want to lay anyone off. So what can we have them do? Anyway, so if you start Chrome with dash dash enable hyphen features equals tab search, then a little button appears to the right of your row of tabs in Chrome, which if you click it, or if you do Control Shift A for activate tab search, you're able to do an incremental search across all of your open tabs. I never have more than five or six in Chrome because, as I said, it's sort of I just fire it up for the moment and then shut it down. But for people who are big Chrome users who end up getting, you know, like, I know there's a tab here somewhere, this may be the thing you that you've been looking for. In ransomware news, a few things. Delaware County, Pennsylvania has paid $500,000 ransom after their systems were hit by the Doppelpaymer ransomware last weekend. And of course, being Pennsylvania, that's on a lot of our politically focused people's radar because it was one of the loudly and hotly contested states in the U.S.'s recent presidential election. So, of course, the first question anyone has is whether the ransomware attack, which was recent, may have had any effect upon the state's election networks. So Delaware County was quick to state that the Bureau of Elections and the county's Emergency Services Department were neither of those were affected. They're on a different network than the one that was hacked. Sources said that the county is in the process of paying this $500,000 ransom since it's insured for such attacks. So they figure, hey, what the heck? Let's, you know, pay the ransom, get the key, and get our systems back up. We're hearing more about Doppelpaymer. And I think this is one that we're going to be talking about much as we've been talking about, you know, Sodino Kibi and Ryuk and so forth. It was derived from its predecessor, BitPaymer, and it shares a large body of its code. It's been Doppelpaymer has been improved to add multi-threaded encryption because, of course, that's what you want in your whole server encryption is speed. So anyway, it's faster now. And in an odd twist, the Doppelpaymer gang apparently advised Delaware County to change all their passwords and also modify their Windows domain configuration to include safeguards from the use of the Mimikatz program. Now, it's not clear what those safeguards would be. Maybe like explicitly look for Mimikatz. Mimikatz, we've talked about it from time to time. It's an open source tool that's been around for about 6 years, since 2014. It's commonly used by ransomware gangs to harvest Windows domain credentials when they get into a compromised network. So it's one of those, you know, lateral movement tools. It doesn't qualify as living off the land because it's typically not present on systems. The ransomware needs to download a copy in order to use it. But it is on GitHub. And its author, 6 years ago, explained that he wrote it as a way to learn C and experiment with locating and extracting Windows credentials from the RAM of running systems. So, yeah, it's, you know, very much like that Active Directory tool we were talking about a few weeks ago. It wasn't ever really written to be used for malicious purposes, but boy, is it handy for those. You know, it extracts things, it finds them and extracts them out of RAM. And Doppelpaymer is, and this gang are using Mimikatz. We did have some follow-up on Canon's attack. We remember we talked about image.canon going down, and I was remarking, it's like, wow, they got their own top-level domain, .canon. I guess if you have enough money, you can say, hey, I want a TLD. So they finally, Canon, finally publicly confirmed what we all pretty much knew based on the evidence, was that they did suffer a ransomware attack in August, and the hackers stole data from the company's servers. At the time, their cloud photo and video storage service, as I was mentioning, image.canon, went down, and that caused some loss of user data. But we noted when we covered this on the podcast, there was a long list of domains that were, you know, of Canon-related services that were all suffering outages. Shortly after the attack, Bleeping Computer obtained information showing that the outage had been caused by the Maze ransomware, M-A-Z-E. And Maze told Bleeping Computer that they had stolen 10 terabytes of data, including private databases, before they had triggered the file encrypting malware on the 5th of August. And interestingly, it turns out the trouble with at least the image.canon site, they claim, was unrelated to anything they did. They confirmed that their actions did not extend to Canon's storage service. So they have no reason to lie, I would think. So just a coincidence. Another recent victim was U.S. Fertility, which is the largest network of fertility centers in the U.S. They've got 55 locations across 10 states, and they were just recently hit by ransomware, encrypting a bunch of their systems. And so they were suffering some outage. I got a kick out of the fact that Ritzau, which is Denmark's largest independent news agency, refused to pay any ransom. They were hit a week ago, last Tuesday. Their spokesman said the Ritzau News Agency, they were founded in 1866, so by Eric Ritzau, so they've been around for a while. The spokesman said the news agency was subjected to an extensive hacker attack on Tuesday, and the hackers have subsequently demanded a ransom to release data. Ritzau has refused to pay money to the hackers. So anyway, they're, you know, a big sprawling organization. About one quarter of their more than 100 servers on their network were encrypted. So their IT department immediately set to work restoring the systems and expected to have them up in a couple days. So that's how you do it. You you have your technology nailed down. If the worst happens, and boy, we're going to be seeing later in just this podcast, we will be looking at one thing after another that would have allowed ransomware guys to get in. And what we know is there are, you know, as many ways in as there are employees, essentially. So the only solution at this point is to be in a position where you can recover. And these guys clearly are. This one actually touches on Chromebooks, which I thought was interesting. Last Wednesday, the Baltimore County, and there's a distinction here between Baltimore County and Baltimore City, as we'll see. The Baltimore County Public Schools posted the news. BCPS can now confirm we were the victim of a ransomware attack that caused systemic interruption to network information systems. Our BCPS technology team is working to address the situation, and we will continue to provide updates as available. For now, please don't use BCPS services. And of course, all of this hits, unfortunately, amid the COVID-19 remote learning phase, you know, virtual education, because we're seeing the expected winter increase in cases. So, you know, school's out, essentially. The Baltimore City Public Schools District, apparently distinct from Baltimore County, also published an alert on its website urging students to only use school-issued devices for virtual learning. Baltimore City wrote, students participating in virtual learning should only use city schools-issued laptops or devices. Do not use devices issued by Baltimore County schools or your personal laptop or computer. They said students without access to a city school's issued device will be granted an excused absence. So, you know, reading between the lines, it sounds like there's some concern that the malware might crawl out onto devices connected to the county network, but not the city network. Or perhaps Baltimore City has additional device protection on their devices. But here's what I thought was sort of interesting. Following last Wednesday's ransomware attack that hit the district's network, Baltimore County Public Schools has now urged students and staff to stop using their school-issued Windows computers and only use Chromebooks and Google accounts. Well, the update on their website... Yeah. The update on their website says, we now know that BCPS-issued Chromebooks were not impacted by the cyber attack. Okay, so that really does suggest that they've detected that students' Windows-based computers may have been affected by this. So perhaps the attack went out and, you know, put malware onto student-issued computers. They said you may now safely use BCPS-issued Chromebooks and BCPS Google accounts for students and staff. Please do not use BCPS-issued Windows-based devices until further notice. So, and school is out yesterday and through today at least. You know, students are instructed to check in with the website to get an update and figure out whether they'll be able to safely reconnect. So, boy, this is creating a mess. Lastly, just because it's big and significant, the French multinational production and distribution firm Banijay Group, SAS, who we probably better know for the various brands they produce, which include MasterChef, Survivor, Big Brother, The Kardashians, Mr. Bean, Black Mirror, Extreme Makeover Home Edition, and Deal or No Deal, among a great many others, was also another recent victim of the Doppelpaymer ransomware. Although they've only shared that they've suffered a cyber attack and that some of their data may have been compromised, the Doppelpaymer ransomware gang is not only claiming responsibility, but proving their involvement by sharing several documents presumably stolen from Banijay's systems. Doppelpaymer is also taunting the French production group by referencing GDPR compliance issues and leaking an internal GDPR compliance document, among others. So, you know, the crooks are having fun at these guys' expense. Okay, in security news, Drupal. The Drupal Security Advisory is titled Drupal Core Critical Arbitrary PHP Code Execution, which is not good news. It was issued last Wednesday. And if any of our listeners are running Drupal-based systems and haven't yet updated, do it now. It is a sweeping vulnerability. Drupal 9.0 needs to be updated to 9.0.9. 8.9 needs to be updated to 8.9.10. 8.8 or earlier to 8.8.12. And Drupal 7 needs to be moved to 7.75. So obviously this is a sweeping problem affecting a whole set of their various lines. The project uses the PEAR, P-E-A-R, archive_tar library. The PEAR archive tar library has released a security update that impacts Drupal. So this is another case like we saw with Google, where, remember, they had the zero day that was discovered because they were using the FreeType library font interpreter. So this is another instance where the use of a third-party library has bit somebody using that library, when a remotely exploitable flaw was discovered that can be referenced through the user of the library. The advisory states that, quote, multiple vulnerabilities are possible if Drupal is configured to allow tar, tar.gz, bz2, or tlz file uploads and processes them. They said to mitigate the issue before fixing it, prevent untrusted users from uploading any of those file types. So here, I mean, we know what this means. This means that there is a glitch in this pair archive tar library such that interpreting when it tries to interpret the content of any of those files, it turns out it's possible to maliciously manipulate those files in order to get remote code execution. So what makes this all the more urgent is that there are known exploits against these vulnerabilities, and some Drupal configurations are known to be vulnerable. Of course, as we know, Drupal is a popular content management system. As of Friday, over 944,000 websites, so just shy of a million, 944,000 websites are using vulnerable Drupal versions out of a total of 1.12 million, according to the official stats. But it turns out even those stats probably underestimate the scope and scale of the vulnerabilities, because only Drupal sites which are using the update stats module are included in the data. So that sounds like something that allows Drupal to you know, keep track of sites. So many more may be at risk. It's Drupal is currently in fourth place among CMS systems on the internet. WordPress, of course, has the huge lead at 63.8% share. Second is Shopify at 5.1%. Joomla is in third place at 3.6%, and Drupal is at 2.5%. But this just goes to show, even a 2.5% share of content management system puts it at 1.12 million sites. And as I said, as of last Friday, just shy of a million of those, 944,000, are using vulnerable Drupal versions, and exploits are known. So, you know, yikes, update. And unfortunately, I think this is another trend that we're seeing. I mean, we've sort of seen it before, even back in the Stage Fright exploit against Android, you know, lo, those many years ago. That was a media codec exploit. So it wasn't formally part of Android. It was like, hey, let's use this codec pack in our OS, and, you know, got bitten by something that somebody else wrote. So, you know, in this day and age, it's difficult to be absolutely responsible for all the code that is running. You know, even I, where I wrote all of my back end web server stuff, but I still have IIS, you know, as, you know, fielding the incoming inquiries. It's very difficult to be an island and get anything useful done. Leo, let's take our second break, and then we're going to talk about the revenge of cheap smart doorbells.
Oh, sounds like a bad choice.
You don't want to use it.
Cheap smart doorbell. Probably
not
a
quite
foolish
as smart
economy.
As you would like.
Yeah. Good. I'd love to. This is a good time to talk about our fine sponsor this week. It's LastPass. You probably heard of them. Have you heard of them? maybe. Yeah. Actually, we really are grateful to LastPass. They've been a really big part of our year, keeping the show, not just this show, but the whole network afloat for the past 365 days has not been an insignificant contribution. So thank you, LastPass. They bought the studio naming rights, all of our shows. They really did a great job for us. So we're very grateful. And one way you could show a little gratitude is by checking out LastPass. I suspect many of you are already using it personally, but I want to encourage you to use it in business as well. That's what we did a few years ago. And, you know, when we started sending employees home, because of quarantine. We did it with some confidence because we knew they were already using LastPass. They were already secure. You know, because companies face cybersecurity threats no matter where the employees are working. Whether they're connected from an office or from a home, the risk of cyber attack, and of course, all you have to do is listen to this show for 5 minutes, and you'll know the risk of data loss, data breaches. That's something companies got to plan for and work to mitigate. You need a solid cybersecurity strategy. Probably more important than ever now that employees are working from home. The Wi-Fi network, the shared devices, they're no longer under your direct control. That's why LastPass is so important for protecting your business. IT and security leaders can take control back of password security with LastPass. They'll have a central dashboard they can access anytime. It'll give them all sorts of information, including password scores, how well your employees are doing to protect your assets. You could see shared accounts. You can monitor group memberships and more. All of that stuff is extremely helpful. Dark web monitoring. So you could see real-time readouts of your business's password hygiene and provide alerts to employees when their credentials could be at risk. LastPass does everything you need. And wherever your organization's source of truth lies, LDAP or whatever you use, LastPass integrates to onboard users, sync groups, revoke access. Couldn't be easier to add a new employee or to subtract an employee. That's exactly the control you need. And the admin privileges, there's more than 100 of them, give us more control. For instance, we require employees use a two-factor. We have minimums for their master password requirements. There's many, many policies like that. LastPass uses something we've talked about on the show a lot, the zero-knowledge security model. Everyone is protected from the individual user to the biggest organization because they just assume that, they don't assume that anybody inside the network is secure. Everybody needs to authenticate. Identity management is such a big part of your overall security strategy. And with LastPass's single sign-on apps, all of their super cool technologies, employees can really experience a more convenient environment while they're more secure. That's important. I think it's something that's very hard to do is increase security and convenience. Things like single sign-on let employees go passwordless, which is fantastic. LastPass, of course, uses strong encryption algorithms, PBKDF2, to make sure brute forcing is much more difficult. Data is only decrypted at device level, never anywhere else. And your password, your master password, is never sent to the cloud or to LastPass. And they support multi-factor authentication, including contextual factors like geolocation and IP address. You got to take a look at LastPass for your home, for your office, for your family. LastPass is a solution that's right for you. This is the time to get working and make sure your business is as safe as it can be. I have to say, it's really a big peace of mind thing for me. LastPass.com/twit. Find out how they can help you. And make sure you go to LastPass.com/twit to let them know you saw it on Security Now. So that way we'll get a little credit for it and a little thank you to LastPass for their support all this year. And thanks to you for supporting us too. LastPass.com/twit. It's been a very interesting year for all of us, that's for sure.
Well, that's the manager that I have on all my devices, Leo.
I know, and so. I'm really thrilled, yeah. I can't believe it was 10 years ago you did that deep dive on LastPass. It's hard to believe. Whew.
Hopefully Joe is out on a boat somewhere.
He's enjoying life. Himself. Yeah, I talked to his niece still works at LastPass, and I met her at the last RSA conference. It was very interesting to talk to her.
Oh,
yeah. Neat okay. Family. Very smart. Okay. On we go.
So hopefully it won't come as a surprise to any of our listeners to learn that they don't want to have off-brand, no-name IoT smart doorbells.
Yeah, that sounds right.
The likes of which are sold on Amazon and eBay. You don't want those anywhere near your homes. Matt Lewis of the NCC Group and their researchers took a look at the operation of 11 off-brand El Cheapo bargain smart doorbells and found their intelligence to be somewhat lacking, shall we say. Matt said, "Our findings could cause issues for consumers and are indicative of a wider culture that favors shortcuts over security in the manufacturing process." Yeah, okay, no big surprise there. He added, however, we're hopeful that the much-anticipated IoT legislation will signal a watershed moment in IoT security. Until this comes to fruition, we must continue to work together to highlight the need for basic security by design principles and educate consumers about the risks and what they can do to protect themselves. So first of all, this IoT legislation Matt's referring to, it's hopeful. It's been moving along since its introduction in 2017 by Senator Mark Warner. And it uses the typical, you know, what can the government do, carrot and stick security requirements. So you need to do these things in order to get a government procurement contract. And it does include a bunch of stuff we need. So clearly, you know, some IoT security aware people were involved. The legislation, if it happens, and it's like it's still alive and maybe it will, it requires that vendors, for example, commit that their IoT devices are patchable. So yay for that. Also that the devices don't contain known vulnerabilities. If a vendor identifies vulnerabilities, that vendor must disclose them to an agency with an explanation of why the device can be considered secure notwithstanding the vulnerability and a description of any compensating controls employed to limit the exploitability and impact of the vulnerability. And then based on that information, an agency's CIO could issue a waiver to request the ability to purchase the device. The third requirement is that the devices rely on standard protocols, which only seems great. Let's not roll our own and say, oh, this is better than anything else. And then fourth, the devices don't contain hard-coded passwords. So that's obviously a really good thing. It's going to be difficult, though, to do, because when you think about it, I mean, hard-coded passwords we know are bad, but not having them is going to require some interesting workarounds. So, you know, the bill is not yet law, and there are exemptions in there that are so large you could drive a truckload of dumb doorbells through them. So, you know, we'll see how this turns out. But it's certainly true that having any sort of legislation would be a lot better than just what we have now, which is this totally unregulated environment. But specifically, of these 11 devices, two of the devices that these guys tested were manufactured by Victure, V-I-C-T-U-R-E, and Ctronics, C-T-R-O-N-I-C-S. They had critical vulnerabilities that could allow bad guys, not surprisingly, to steal the user's home network password. The flaws would also allow attackers to hack not only the doorbells, but also the residential router that the doorbell was connected to, and any other smart devices in the home, you know, thermostat, other cameras, and even get into household computers. For example, this Victure smart video doorbell is its formal name, was found to be sending the customer's home Wi-Fi network name and password unencrypted to servers in China. So, you know, there is absolutely no need for a locally connecting Wi-Fi device to export its local network credentials to anywhere. But, you know, you buy some Victure smart doorbell, you know, from Guangdong, China, and plug it in. And I mean, you know, hey, look, it works. Well, yeah, but it's also sent your network credentials to China. You know, maybe that's not a big problem, but it doesn't have to do that. There's no conceivable use case for it doing that. So, you know, maybe that's not what you want. And remember, Leo, that the visual that we set up on a podcast few months ago. Actually, we were talking about this after I had attached a few smart plugs to my network. I wanted some simple timers.
Yeah.
And we were I did add an IoT thermostat to my environment here, and I had also a humidity sensor and a separate logging thermostat, and I could just imagine a globe showing, and of course in movies like War Games, we see all the little lines tracing an arc through the upper atmosphere of incoming missiles. Well, imagine all of the IoT devices in the U.S. with their connections back to servers in China. I mean, that's where they're connecting. That's where my doorbell. I don't have a doorbell. That's where my thermostat and my IoT plugs are connecting, which of course is why I would argue it is crucial that they be on an isolated network, as all of mine are. When you picture that, all of these tens, hundreds of millions of connections, we remember that story about the Trojan horse from olden times. So anyway, Matt said, if stolen, this data obviously could allow a hacker to access people's home Wi-Fi, enabling them to target their private data, access any smart devices they own, and so forth. The researchers found that another device bought from eBay and Amazon without any clear brand associated to it. It was literally a no-name smart doorbell, was vulnerable to the crack exploit. That's the key reinstallation attack that was discovered 3 years ago in 2017. So these devices don't have up-to-date Wi-Fi stacks? Imagine that. On the other hand, why would they? Of course, the crack attack opens any attached network to intrusion by allowing the network's WPA and WPA2 encryption to be cracked without much effort, given, state-of-the-art cracking tools. So, of course, again, none of this comes as any great surprise, but I think it's nice to examine some specifics from time to time because it's too easy to sort of wave off generalities. The advice, of course, if you want to buy a smart doorbell, there is, I would say, very good reason, especially a smart doorbell. You got a video camera, right? That anybody monitoring it can see what's going on out of your front door, can see when you all leave the house, can see when you come in, can watch what's going on around you. I would argue there's very good reason to stick with major brands. You're going to pay more, but I mean, you have to care about security, and unless you take personal responsibility for what one of these devices does, you have to isolate it on its own network. And I would argue, buy from a major brand, even if there is a problem. And we know these things are going to have problems. The problems will make the headlines. The vulnerabilities will be found and cured responsibly and promptly, as opposed to absolutely never. So anyway, I just thought it neat that these guys took the time to just sort of say, let's take a look at these doorbells and see what they're doing. And yeah, to no one's surprise. Now, the good news on the most recent of three Tesla key fob hacks is that it's not easy to do. But it also shows that even well-designed devices can get hacked. As Tesla found out for the third time from this one researcher, and we've spoken of him before, Leonard Wouters, W-O-U-T-E-R-S. He's a PhD student at the Computer Security and Industrial Cryptography Group at the Catholic University of Leuven. That's KU Leuven. We've also we've covered a bunch of the work coming out of there. located in Belgium. He came up with, the press said he discovered this. Well, I guess, but you know, it's not like he tripped over it, as we'll see. But he worked out a method to overwrite and hijack the firmware of Tesla Model X. Is that Model 10? Is that how we say it? Model 10?
Yeah.
Key fobs.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. Apple is 10, Tesla is X.
Okay, Model
X. That's very confusing.
Thank you. Because it's not Space 10, right?
Right. It's Space X. Yeah, no, so, it's a Model X. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So what this guy did, he figured out a way to a hack that would allow him to steal any car that isn't running the latest software update. His attack only takes a few minutes to execute and requires inexpensive hardware. But I'll explain it. It's not that easy to do. This guy, same guy, has previously produced successful attacks against Tesla's security in 2018 and 2019. And now he adds 2020.
He better get his PhD. I'm just saying. He deserves it.
Yeah.
He's earned it.
Yeah. And you know that when he called the Tesla security people, they took his call.
Oh, yeah. They fixed it. We should point out. Yeah.
Yes. So he explained that his third attack works thanks to a flaw in the firmware update process of the Tesla Model X key fobs. It can be exploited using an electronic control unit, you know, the brains, the ECU, salvaged from an older Model X vehicle, which it turns out they've been around long enough, they can easily be acquired online on like from eBay or other stores or forums selling used Tesla car parts. Wouters said attackers can modify the older ECU to trick a victim's key fob into believing the ECU belonged to its paired vehicle, right? So you're using this ECU that you bought used to trick the victim's key into believing its pairing with its own car. Once that's done, once you've pulled off this trick, then the ECU is able to push a malicious firmware update out to the key fob over Bluetooth. Since the key fob update mechanism was not being properly secured, they were then able to wirelessly compromise the key to take full control over it. And subsequently, they could obtain valid unlock messages to unlock the target car later. Okay, so here's how a whole attack works in practice. The attacker approaches the owner of a Tesla Model X vehicle. In this first phase of the attack, they must briefly get within about 5 meters of the victim. So at that point, they're probably at Bluetooth low energy. Right. Later, it switches to full Bluetooth. But at this point, they need to be within 5 meters of the victim to allow the older modified ECU, that is this spoofing ECU, to wake up and ensnare the victim's key fob. The attacker then pushes the malicious firmware update into the victim's key. Although this phase, after that initial contact, which can be brief, but it has to be close, now they're able to be about within 30 meters of the victim. And it takes about a minute and a half, about 90 seconds, to execute the firmware push into the victim's key. But that at least allows the attacker to put some distance between themselves and the targeted Tesla owner, thus reducing suspicion. They don't have to hang around for a minute and a half. Once the victim's key fob has been hacked, the attacker is then able to extract car unlock messages from the compromised fob. The attacker then uses these unlock messages to enter the victim's car. That gets them into the car. The attacker then connects the older ECU to the hacked Tesla's car diagnostics connector, which is normally used by Tesla technicians to service the car. The attacker uses this connector and another couple minutes to pair their own key fob to the car, which they are then later able to use to start the vehicle and drive away. So essentially, the attack is use an old ECU, get close to somebody with, you know, any model, any not yet updated Tesla Model X, for a total of about a minute and a half, most of which time you can spend at a distance, that subverts the key in order to get it to release a bunch of unlock messages that it has stored. The bad guy then uses those to unlock the car, to get into the car, and trick the car then into pairing it with a new key, essentially adding that the attacker's key to the permanent paired list. And then they've got a completely valid key that allows them to do anything that a valid owner of the car would do. So again, not easy, but clever. The downside is the attack uses a relatively bulky rig. You know, this ECU is not small, so you got to stick it in a backpack or a bag, or maybe like in another car that's parked next to the victim or something. But, you know, still, the attack is feasible, and it's not expensive. You need a $35 Raspberry Pi, a $30 CAN bus shield on the Raspberry Pi in order to connect to the Tesla's CAN bus, a modified key fob, and that older ECU from a salvaged vehicle. Apparently, those are $100 now on eBay, and also about a $30 lithium polymer battery in order to power the whole portable rig. And of course, being a responsible lad, after discovering the bug and developing the exploit earlier this summer, he reported it to Tesla's security team in mid-August. Only after Tesla began rolling out an over-the-air software update to all Model X cars did Leonard then publish his findings. And the software update containing the fix is 2020.48. So don't leave the garage without it. And
that's an expensive vehicle, so it may be a lot of work, but it's also justified if you can get it. I mean, it's well over $100,000 vehicle. So
yeah. And you know, again, it's a rolling computer. It's funny. There's some commercial on some channel that I listen to where someone is saying, it's, you know, talking about someone's car. Have you ever looked under the hood? It's like a computer on wheels. And I'm thinking,
duh.
No, it's not like a computer on wheels. It is a computer on wheels.
Yeah, my Tesla was a beta computer on wheels. That's for sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And you were the beta tester.
I was the beta tester.
What was it? The like reverse went out or something?
No.
You would
drive it. Think I had it in reverse. I could have sworn, but it went forward.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Right.
And it dinged a car in front of me. I was in a driveway. But then I called them and they said, well, no, we were looking at the logs. You didn't have it in reverse. It's like, oh, I didn't realize you had logs. So they record everything. Jeez Louise. And then there were a few other things. The door kept closing on Lisa. She didn't like that.
Yeah,
it's supposed to have all these sensors in it, but it turned out there really weren't that many.
Put you off a little bit.
Yeah. She finally got to the point where she said, look, before you close the doors, because you know, they're all automatic, you have to shout, doors are closing, and wait for an acknowledgement that everybody is out of the reach of the door, especially those gullwing doors, because they clonk you right on the head. And then they had a – I can go on. You probably don't want me to. But it had a seat that tried to eat us once. But that's
did hear you say at some point – it wasn't on this podcast – that you were not planning to buy another Tesla.
No, I'm not. And mostly, it wasn't the bad experience, although Lisa didn't like it. It was just that there were issues with parts and delays and stuff, and I just thought, I want to buy it from a company that actually makes cars for a living.
Well, and you were a pioneer.
I wanted to support Elon. I did. Right there, first in line. Yeah, and I'm gonna. My next car is electric, but it's made by Ford. Perhaps you've heard of them. Yeah. You know what though? I would trust Elon with security more than I would trust Ford. Who knows? The new Ford uses an app on the phone to open the door.
The good news is nobody now
wants a Ford.
Can use the excuse of, we really didn't consider security.
Right, exactly.
It's like, sorry, honey, that ship has sailed. So, as we were expecting, certificate authorities have adapted to the new single year certs. Traditional high reputation non-automated certificate authorities are reacting to the browser industry's decision, which, as we know, it was initially instigated by Apple, but then quickly adopted with some sigh of relief because Google was trying this and couldn't get it to happen. Apple just said, we're doing it, to enforce a maximum life on browser certs of 398 days. And as we know, this went into effect on September 1st of this year, affecting any certificates issued from September 1st on. And this morning, I received a note from my chosen and quite favorite certificate authority, DigiCert, explaining the way their new multi-year plans would function. The essence is what we expected. Despite the shortening of individual certificate lifetimes, that is, the cert itself cannot be valid for more than 398 days, it will now be possible to sign up in advance for a multi-year commitment. DigiCert provides up to 6 years, and as you'd expect, a longer commitment results in a lower cost per year, which seems fair since you're giving them your money up front. And in return, they're giving you a discount. And once that's set up, you're in control of your own certificate renewal, able to reissue certificates at any time that's needed. And in DigiCert's case, this is essentially an extension of the system they've had in place for years. I've mentioned on this podcast a number of times how convenient it has been to be able to issue a certificate at midnight on the weekend and receive it within minutes. You know, essentially DigiCert decouples the authorization of proving I am who I say I am from the issuing of certificates, so that they do periodically need me to re-verify my identity, my corporate affiliation, and so forth. They do all of that validation automatically every so often, which then frees me within those windows to issue certs whenever I want to. So all certificate authorities are now needing to compete with Acme certificate automation, which of course was pioneered by Let's Encrypt. And as we know, I used to use EV certs and had proudly had the Gibson Research Corporation in green in the browsers, but then the browsers made the decision across the board to de-emphasize the display, any display that certs were extended validation. And also because my use of subdomains had been growing with, squirrel.grc.com, forums.grc.com, news.grc.com, and EV certs do not support wildcards by policy. It just made more sense to switch from EV to OV, or organization validation certs, which is where I am now. So anyway, I still think that given the decidedly mixed blessing of certificate automation, yes, it makes them free. It allows you to have encryption. It really doesn't do the job you could get about authentication, though, because we know that the fraudulent issuance rate is exceedingly high with automated certs. So there's a trade-off. And I still think it makes sense to add an indicator in a cert about whether it was issued by automation or under human supervision of some kind. That seems like a useful flag, but maybe that's just another thing users won't pay any attention to. I don't know. Unfortunately, nearly 50,000 Fortinet VPN credentials have been posted online through no fault of Fortinet's, I should add. Last year, it was revealed, and we talked about it at the time, that the FortiOS, which underlies the Fortinet VPN, was subject to a path traversal flaw. It was assigned a CVE of 2018-13379. And the NIST description of the vulnerability reads, an improper limitation of a path name to a restricted directory. And then it has in parens path traversal in Fortinet OS, and it's got a range of OSs under their SSL VPN web portal, allows an unauthenticated attacker to download system files via special crafted HTTP resource requests. On August 28th of last year, 2019, Fortinet posted, at the recent Black Hat 2019 conference held in Las Vegas this past August 3rd through 8th, security researchers discussed their discovery of security vulnerabilities that impacted several security vendors, including Fortinet. All of the vulnerabilities impacting Fortinet were fixed in April and May of 2019, meaning, months before this disclosure, they got all this fixed. And, of course, being a responsible company, Fortinet had also worked to notify all of their users to update their systems. And, of course, despite their efforts to get their users to update, we know how that probably went. The vulnerability allows Fortinet VPN system files, or allowed, I should say, in the past, to be obtained remotely and without any of that pesky authentication. This is in the news today because a large, nearly 50,000 records worth of previous Fortinet VPN logon credential information has recently surfaced on the dark web and is now being passed around. It's a 7 gigabyte archive of individual SSL VPN web session files, which contain session-related information, including plain text usernames and passwords and the IPs both of Fortinet VPN users and the IPs they were connected to, banks, telecoms, government organizations from around the world. Fortinet is a real company, and so they've got a big high-end install base. Since the aggregated and leaked archive contains all the login information needed, patching any still vulnerable or even previously vulnerable Fortinet VPNs at this point won't prevent any of their accounts from still being used. So remediation, which Fortinet was very clear to explain in their disclosure, requires not only patching the VPN, but then also canceling and reissuing all of the previous VPN accounts because they may have been able to get loose. So basically, what was obtainable back then at the time, known before the Black Hat conference and foreclosed. But again, this is the problem we have in our industry with patches not being applied. A bunch of people still got their logs exfiltrated from them. So anyway, what we really need somehow is a way of closing this loop, of getting these connected systems updated, or at least getting notices to the affected individuals out in time. And speaking of accounts, more than 300,000 Spotify accounts have been hacked. The security industry has renamed what we once called a brute force attack. Now we're referring to these as credential stuffing because, you know, that's essentially the process. You're stuffing credentials down into a form on a server or an API access point, you know, trying to get a brute force success. And of course, as we know, it's typically performed by taking a list of previously used usernames and passwords and just pounding away at some poorly protected service attempting to get a successful logon. And I say poorly protected because today, any service worth its salt will observe that some attacker at some IP is attempting to brute force their way in. I mean, it only takes, what, 5 or 6 attempts with wildly different usernames and passwords to think, okay, this doesn't look legit. And yes, a large multi-IP botnet could also be used so that it's not just one IP or a few IPs pounding on the service. But, okay, so it's a more diffuse attack. But it's still trivial, or it should be, to quickly blacklist even a large number of IPs which are making repeated unsuccessful attempts to log in. And when I say repeated, the list, it turns out, was 380 million. 380 million usernames and passwords. But Spotify doesn't do that. And of course, they just allowed this attack to go on. Spotify provides no such protection, nor does Spotify provide multi-factor authentication, which would have also successfully thwarted any sort of credential stuffing attacks. So it should come as no surprise that Spotify's history has been defined by years of their users complaining that their Spotify accounts were hacked after passwords were changed, new playlists would appear in their profiles, their family accounts had strangers added from other countries. You know, that's what happens in today's world when authentication is weak. VPN Mentor produced a report titled "Spotify Targeted in Potential Fraud Scheme." And in the report they wrote, "We unearthed an Elasticsearch database containing over 380 million records, including login credentials and other user data being validated against the Spotify service." In other words, this database showed that it had successfully been used to log into 300,000, actually between 300,000 and 350,000 individual Spotify accounts. They said that the origins of the database and how the fraudsters were targeting Spotify were both unknown. The hackers were possibly using login credentials stolen from another platform, another app or website, and using them to access the Spotify accounts. They said, working with Spotify, they wrote, "We confirmed that the database belonged to a group or individual using it to defraud Spotify and its users. We also helped the company isolate the issue and ensure its customers were safe from the attack." So they started with about 380 million records, which allowed them to get into between 300 and 350,000 individual accounts. So that meant they had a hit rate of around 0.1%, or like 1 in 1,000. So certainly enough successes to be useful. They notified when they found this database on an Elasticsearch site, they contacted Spotify back in July of this year, informed them of the exposed database and the threat it would produce. Spotify reacted immediately, initiated a rolling reset of passwords for all the affected users. And this database showed where login had been successful. where this username and password had successfully logged in. It was flagged in the database as, yep, this is a good one. So they got the database, performed resets for all affected users, resolved the problem. So, you know, the lesson for, of course, end users, we know, never reuse passwords, make them long and high entropy, and if possible, always add multi-factor authentication when it's provided. The lesson for Spotify and other services, protect your users by spotting and proactively blocking clearly malicious authentication attempts. It's easy to do. Do it. And immediately offer and promote time-based multi-factor authentication. Like, why wouldn't you? Crazy.
It does seem rare to see a company that doesn't have two-factor these days. I had no idea Spotify didn't allow two-factor. That's crazy.
Just like
I'm surprised.
Maybe they, you know, don't want to make it difficult to log on, don't want to bite the bullet.
Plus, maybe they figure, oh, it's just a music service. Who cares?
Maybe. And in fact, when it talked about defrauding users, I thought, well, okay, you know, it's not clear if you log in as a user off, you know, normally you're not able to see your payment information. So they wouldn't be able to get that. Would be masked.
The defrauding is adding Yevgeny to your family account. Oh, my brother in Borislava. Yeah, of course. He's good guy. I love him. Strange taste in music. That's the worst thing that would happen. So you all of a sudden get all this, you know, weird music out of your taste in
spam in your Spotify account.
Yeah, exactly. Why is he subscribing to all these criminal podcasts?
Yeah. Last piece of news is that mobile device management, MDM, as we know, is a popular means for enterprises to manage the configurations of their mobile phone fleet. And because MDM servers, by nature of the way they work, must be publicly accessible to remotely manage those mobile devices, they are a natural target for bad guys. That means when a remotely exploitable code execution vulnerability is found, enterprises need to take heed. One of the more popular MDM services platform, MobileIron, is vulnerable to just such exploitation, which carries a CVSS score of 9.8, which, while not 10, is, you know, up there. The flaw was reported to MobileIron by Orange Tie from DevCore. It exists across various components of the platform. Actually, I don't know the nature of it. I didn't take any time to dig into it because, you know, it's been fixed and everyone needs to update. But it's in the MobileIron Core, which is a component of the MobileIron platform that serves as the admin console, and in MobileIron Connector, a component that adds real-time connectivity to the backend. Also impacted is Sentry, an inline gateway that manages, encrypts, and secures traffic between the mobile device and the backend enterprise systems, and the monitor and reporting database, which provides comprehensive performance management functionality. So whatever this thing is, you know, it's like a fundamental flaw in something about what MobileIron was doing. Sounds like a big mess. And it's certainly not one that any enterprise wants to have on their network. MobileIron said in an update last week that it had been engaging in proactive outreach to help customers secure their systems. And they estimate that 90 to 95% of all devices under mobile management are now being managed on patched and updated versions of the MobileIron software. And the company stated it will continue following up with the remaining customers where they can determine that they haven't yet patched the affected products. So, again, mistakes happen. Maintaining tight lines of communication is the key. And we really do need automated updating, or at the very least, automated update notifications. You know, we're getting there, but boy, the progress is slow. Okay, let's take our last break. then I want to briefly talk about where I am with the Salvation trilogy.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to share...
No spoilers. I haven't started it yet.
No spoilers. No, I never do those.
That. I know.
And I was afraid that John might be further along than I was and would say something in my ear.
You're close. He's at 85 and you're at 92. It's amazing.
Correct. anyway, something really significant has happened with the future of SpinRite and SSDs. And then we're going to wrap up by talking about the problems with DNS consolidation.
Exciting. But first, a word from Worldwide Technology and Fortinet. You were just talking about them. WWT offers security solutions and services that will protect your business. They're the kings of enterprise offerings, both hardware, software, consultancies, support, application development, security assays. They do it all. You know, attackers are always updating their strategies. They've got a, you know, a million-man workforce constantly improving their attacks. Are you prepared? Have you updated your strategies? Worldwide Technology can help your organization organize, prepare, and combat against next-generation threats. You want a company that has the vision, the services, the capabilities needed to deliver security controls and reduce the risk for your organization, and that's exactly what WWT does. Their team provides resources and platforms that make that possible. With over three decades of experience, WWT has a proven track record to really help you succeed. A few case studies you might have seen. You can certainly see more if you go to wwt.com/twit, but I'll give you a few just as an example. They worked with a big healthcare organization. They were doing a security risk assessment on something that healthcare organizations really want, but are really vital to secure. That's the electronic health record technology, right? WWT consultants use their expert knowledge, their state-of-the-art tools, and in-depth analysis, skill training, and repetition to complete their assessment. The kind of the great takeaway that I know you guys, you Security Now listeners, will enjoy, 90% of the vulnerabilities they found in this technology could be fixed by putting in, I think you might even already know the answer, a comprehensive, systematic approach for patching. It's easy. But WWT showed them how, helped them do it, trained the employees. They also worked with a retail bank, big company, to help achieve their primary goal of establishing an infrastructure that could survive a catastrophic cybersecurity event. You might be thinking along those lines, too. You read these headlines in the newspaper about Canon, and you go, hoy, yoy, yoy, I don't want, not me. WWT helped this bank reduce system outages by 40%. And by the way, they saw an ongoing cost savings of 48%. And that was all done through infrastructure automation. They help with that kind of thing, too. Whether it's your security strategy, your endpoint security, your network security, your identity and access management, setting up a zero trust architecture, or even just to automate and orchestrate your security operations, WWT can help. They are the kings. They're really the best and nice people, too. See how WWT can protect your business and your intellectual property and your assets with a holistic security approach. Let them help you secure your business. Now more than ever, this is what we need. WWT.com/twit. You'll be working with a company that really plans for the future. That I'm so impressed by their commitment to improving, to never resting on their laurels, to always finding out what the latest, greatest, best practices are. You want to work with somebody like this. Let WWT help you. WWT.com/twit. Worldwide Technologies, delivering outcomes and modernizing IT infrastructure all over the world. They're Silicon Valley in St. Louis. Great bunch of people at WWT. I'm sitting out here looking out the window, Steve, because I'm expecting a delivery from DHL, and I see the van drive by, turn the wrong way, go down that road, and I'm going, oh, no. You know what I ordered? I think you'd be kind of interested, even that you use a Kindle, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's this thing called a Remarkable 2. They came out with this e-ink. It's legal size note-taking, but you can also read books on it, annotate them. And if you have them in the EPUB form, and I know that you probably can get all the Peter F. Hamilton stuff in EPUB. You could put them on this thing. It's a Linux computer with an e-ink display, but now it's going that way. So I may never see it again.
Is it 8.5 by 11? Is it like a full sheet of paper?
It's called the Remarkable 2. They did one earlier. Let me see if I can find it.
And obviously markable as in markup.
Yeah. And it has a nice texture so that you can, when you're using the pen on it, it feels right. Good. I think it's at least 8. Yeah, maybe it's a little smaller than 8.5 by 11.
Pretty.
Yeah, I think it's going to be kind of interesting. And I like the idea of annotating, you know, putting PDFs on it and annotating documents and stuff like that. Anyway, I hope whoever got it enjoys it.
He'll come back. He's just delivering something else.
No. It's been 20 minutes. I'm just watching from. He went to that parking lot and then he never emerged. So I don't know how he. It happens all the time. And then the people across the street say, "Your package came here again." So maybe I'll pop over and see. Anyway, let's continue on.
So I did just want to say that it's been a long, slow burn. And frankly, even sometimes a little bit of a slog, since Peter Hamilton packs his novels with seemingly endless detail.
Oh, man, it's long. It's a trilogy.
Oh, my Lord. And sometimes you're like, why do I really need to know about this? But, it all comes together. And now I don't ever want it to end.
Oh.
It is, as you said, I'm at 92% of the third book. And oh, my goodness. I will be rereading what I just read last night over again because it is so good. And the other thing, I don't know what Peter has in store, but I still have 8% left. And like we've sort of wrapped up most of what I were expecting. There is a big loose end, but it feels like there may be a surprise.
Yeah.
Because I will never forget the surprise, the breathtaking surprise at the end of Fallen Dragon, and where is like this happens, and it's like, and then suddenly everything that, you'd been set up for this like surprise. And so anyway, we know he's fully capable of doing this. And I just wanted to say, wow. It was the, what was the first crazy series that he made really popular?
Was it The Abyss I love all of his stuff.
Yeah, it was the very early stuff.
Not the one with Al Capone. Oh, Pandora's Star.
Yes, that's what I was thinking of.
And then Judas Unchained.
Oh my God! And then
Saga.
Pandora's Star.
Yeah.
Pandora's Star and Judas Unleashed.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Or Unchained or something.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's the they call it the Commonwealth Saga. Yeah. Really good. Ooh. That's another that's another trilogy. The one that I didn't like with Al Capone was that was just two. You're right. Was the Chronicle of the
Fallers.
Yeah, and
in fact, the one with Al Capone, it kind of went off the reservation at some point.
It got a little weird. Literally, Al Capone is in it.
In the surprising news category, the work on the read speed benchmark is tantalizingly close to completion. I finally published a first release candidate, which had the effect of soliciting some additional testing. And the result was that we discovered a couple of final things that need a little polish. And I'll get back to that this evening. But the benchmark has revealed something that's quite exciting. So I reached out to Alan Malventano, who you know, Leo.
He's like the king of SSDs. A piece of perspective, and then he got a job at Intel doing SSDs over there. So he really knows his stuff. Yeah.
Right. So I sent him an email titled "Interesting SSD Timing Reveals ... something. And I showed him what we were seeing, and you and I think next week, you and I will be looking at the same file. So now he's over at Intel with a title of Storage Technical Analyst. And I'll go into more detail about this soon, as soon as I have something for everyone to play with. But it looks very much as though SpinRite will have an extremely bright future in SSD maintenance and repair. The benchmark provides read timing resolution with an uncertainty of less than 200 picoseconds in its ability to measure response time. And it turns out that this can allow it to spot regions of SSD that are weakening long before they fail. In the time domain, it would be like having a microscope with an extremely high magnification. And what this reveals, it reveals the effects of mild regional slowdown, which it turns out is a natural consequence of SSD management through something known as the FTL, the flash translation layer, which is the logic which manages the mapping of the underlying SSD media to its external presentation. And it turns out that standard usage of many SSDs will result in a mild reduction in performance. Many of the early testers of the benchmark are noting that the front of their SSDs are a little slower in performing than later on, because the benchmark tests five locations on each drive. The front of the drive zero at the 0%, the middle at 50%, and the end at 100%, and then also the two quarter points at 25% and 75%. So you can sort of see, you know, one of the first things we saw was that the beginning of people's SSDs were slower, which was like, what? Well, it turns out that the usage causes fragmentation of the SSD, very much like sort of akin to traditional hard drive fragmentation as a consequence of use. There, it's at the file system level. Here, it's actually at the, you know, like below the logical access level. But we're also seeing something very different, which is what caused me to send this note to Alan. It reveals when that FTL layer is having extreme difficulty reading a region of its media. On today's multi-level cells, you know how like we used to have single-level cells where you'd store either like zero charge or full charge, and that would mean that you could store one binary bit. But now, of course, in this quest for greater density, if you were to store four levels of charge, then that would allow you to store two binary bits in a single cell. What they're often doing now is what they call triple level, but it's actually eight levels of charge and 3 bits per cell. And in fact, Leo, believe it or not, this technology has gotten so crazy that SSDs will advertise what their maximum capacity is, but they will, because it's more reliable and you may never need maximum capacity, they're even able to start out using 1 bit per cell until the whole SSD fills up at the 1 bit per cell level, and then dynamically start allocating 2 or 3 bits as you continue to fill up the SSD.
Wow.
And in fact, that may be because SSDs are not allocating.
The capacity goes up as time goes by.
Yeah, well, the bit density of the actual SSD capacitor is increased.
Jeez Louise.
So that it goes from only storing a 0 or a
right,
1
right.
to storing a 0, 1, 2, or 3 to storing a 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7
wow.
As you actually need more of the capacity of the SSD.
And that's part of the wear leveling too, I would imagine. It gives them, they can spread it out over the platter or whatever it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the multi-level cells they take longer to read. I mean, sorry, they do take longer to read. They also take longer to write because you're needing to write multiple levels into different cells. And I mean, it's
amazing.
Nuts.
It's amazing.
Leo, the technology that's hidden behind these things is
yeah.
crazy.
Yeah.
So, and Alan uses the term cell drift, because that's another thing that can happen, is that, you know, that's, and in fact, we talked about this a long time ago, where SSDs that were stored in a hot environment tended to lose their charge faster than those stored in a cold environment, which makes sense just in terms of, you know, electron activity. Anyway, it turns out that on today's multi-level cells, this flash translation layer may need to tweak its cell voltage thresholds in order to deal with what Alan calls cell drift, and or apply extensive levels of error correction in order to recover a specific region's original contents. What we are seeing and what the benchmark reveals is that you'll be cruising along and suddenly come to a grinding halt while a particularly troublesome region is being read. And so what happens on lower-end SSDs, they may not be using hardware acceleration in order to perform the error correction math on the fly. So they're having to do a firmware algorithm in order to recover the contents of a specific sector that you're asking to read. It may be that identifying and then applying careful selective block aligned rewriting will, a future spin write will be able to literally recharge and realign these drifting cells to bring a possibly endangered region back up to speed. And then if an area cannot be repaired, then oddly enough, we may be back to the very early concept of marking a region as unreliable and taking it out of the file system. And when you think about it, with the crazy size of today's mass storage, it makes a huge amount of sense to remove a tiny fraction of possibly unreliable storage, since everybody has way more than they will ever be able to use.
Right.
Anyway, when I suggested this in my email to Alan, he replied, quote, he said, actually, there's no need to map out clusters at the file system level, and this is one of the cases where it may be beneficial to go, and he put in quotes, old school spin write and rewrite successfully slowly read sectors. He said, unlike hard drives, SSDs won't typically do any rewriting on their own. Even if a sector was very, and he had an asterisk, difficult to successfully read. So these very slow reading areas can be remedied by rewriting them. You can minimize, he said, an increase in media / FTL fragmentation by ensuring you do these operations in 4K or 8K aligned chunks and not just single sectors. And of course, you know, we know that a future spin write would do both. It would characterize the overall performance of the media to learn how it performs. It would then identify any regions that are clearly operating far below average, and then first attempt to resolve the trouble with careful selective rewriting. But if the region did not increase its read speed, if it refused to be healed, then it would do what SpinWrite originally did back in version 1.0, which is to take that region out of the file system and relocate any data that it has to safety, and then allow SpinWrite to be used on SSDs as a really proactive preventive management tool.
That's really great news. It makes SpinWrite even more useful on SSDs. That's
yeah,
great.
Well, and in fact, you know, to our surprise, a few years ago, we started, sharing testimonials from people whose SSDs and various types of thumb drives were being brought back to life by SpinWrite. And it was like, what? Well, you know, now we know how. Oh, and I mentioned that SpinWrite will be fast. The benchmark is reading 544 megabytes per second from a 500 gigabyte Samsung 860 EVO SSD when attached to a SATA 3 port. That means that Spinrite would be able to perform this sort of whole drive performance scan in 919 seconds or fewer than 15 and a half minutes.
Nice.
So it becomes, you know, practical and feasible again to use Spinrite for this.
Nice. Really exciting.
Yeah. Very fun. And our listeners are all going to be able to find out how their drives, both spinning and solid state, perform in this way. I would imagine next week we'll have this thing ready. So anyway.
Can't wait.
Very cool.
Nice.
DNS consolidation. Despite previous teachable moments, such as when Dyn DNS, we all remember that, Leo, we talked about it 4 years ago, it was in 2016, mm-hmm. When Dyn DNS was attacked, and the result was huge swaths of the web became inaccessible, what happened was our dependence upon fewer and fewer large providers, in other words, DNS consolidation, was revealed. And since then, it has only grown. Today, for example, the research that was just performed reveals that if Cloudflare, AWS, or GoDaddy were to go down, around 40% of Alexa's top 100,000 websites would also go down due to a failure of their now consolidated DNS. And for those who weren't around, when we covered this 4 years ago in 2016, Dyn, which was subsequently purchased by Oracle, Dyn is a provider of managed DNS services. It was a victim of a massive DDoS attack by the Mirai botnet that crippled the company's operations and took down the DNS of more than 175,000 websites. And although some sites managed to remain accessible thanks to well-configured secondary DNS servers that had been wisely kept on different networks, most sites were not prepared and remained down for nearly a day as Dyn worked to remediate the attack. So, a team of researchers at Carnegie Mellon University have conducted a large-scale study of the top 100,000 websites on the internet to see whether and how those responsible for website operations reacted to this attack, if at all, 4 years ago, and how many are still operating with a single DNS provider and no effective backup. Their 14-page research paper is titled "Analyzing Third-Party Service Dependencies in Modern Web Services, Have We Learned from the Mirai Dyn Incident?" And for anyone who's interested, I have a link in the show notes to their 14-page paper. It was presented during the ACM's Internet Measurement Conference last month. And in it, they show that today, in 2020, 89.2% of all websites use a third-party DNS provider rather than managing their own DNS server. So, you know, that's not so bad, right? 89.2% are using a third-party provider. On the other hand, that's a lot of concentration because there aren't that many third-party providers. And if those third parties go down, that takes out everybody who's using them. So them needing to stay up is important. And, you know, yes, a company like Cloudflare is super robust, is doing everything it can to stay up. But you know, even mistakes happen, even if it's not a big attack. And in fact, we talked about there was a Cloudflare mistake of this sort, I don't know, a year or so ago. And they fixed it quickly. And we talked about it in detail. It was a really interesting mistake in the management of their routing that caused everything, all their traffic, to go to one place, which just collapsed it. They also found, to make matters even more fragile than this concentration onto a few third-party DNS providers, that 84.8% of all analyzed websites relied upon a single DNS provider without any backup redundancy to which they could switch in case of a failure or attack. Now, I mean, I get it. People don't understand, I guess, what that means. Or maybe it's just not really that important that they stay online. And so there's, you know, they're making a deliberate trade-off of convenience versus reliability. But the awareness of the need for DNS redundancy dates all the way back to the birth of DNS. You know, we're all techies listening to this podcast. We've all seen at least two fields or a pair of DNS IPs appearing wherever configured DNS addresses are. I mean, you always have two DNS IPs. You know, it's regarded as best practice to have redundant DNS servers on non-adjacent IPs, typically on differing Class C networks. And of course, for true redundancy, the further apart they are, the better. It'd be great if they were actually on entirely separate providers. But if the configured servers are actually sitting next to one another in the same rack, that is, if they're just, you know, they it's like, hey, yeah, they deliberately, I know that, for example, Cox, that I have IPs, they look like they're on different C-class networks, but it's like, okay, what do you want to bet they're in the same room? Anyway, if that's the case, any benefit is illusory, of course. So the CMU team says that the number of sites having no effective redundancy has increased by 4.7% since 2016. And they suggest that this demonstrates that the lessons website operators might have learned following the Dyn DDoS attack and outage were instead lost, if they even ever were learned and forgotten. They point out that while two of the top 100 sites, did add backup DNS servers since 2016, that means what, 98 of the top 100 did not. They also noted that smaller websites continued to use a single DNS service provider without any backup. And in most cases, the operators of these smaller sites chose a large, well-known provider, thus contributing to the long-observed tendency toward the consolidation among ISPs. In the show notes, I have a chart from their paper, which just sort of shows, based on the Alexa rank, whether you're in the top 100, 1,000, 10,000, or 100,000, what is the amount of third-party dependency, critical dependency, and how much and how often you have redundancy. They say that the top three DNS providers, Cloudflare at 24%, AWS at half that at 12%, and GoDaddy at a third of that at 4%, are the single DNS providers of around 38% of the top 100,000 sites in the Alexa ranking. And in addition, four DNS providers are the lone critical providers for more than half of the Alexa top 100. So four providers used by the top 100. So, you know, any intentional attack or perhaps the occasional accidental network hardware or software failure at one of these three providers could bring down a large chunk of the internet. And the researchers also observe that when the much broader Alexa top 100,000 sites are examined to reveal an apparently much broader base of 10,000 DNS providers. So, right, when you, naturally, when you look across a much larger cross-section, then you're going to see 10,000 DNS providers. But most of those 10,000 DNS providers still have indirect dependencies back to only a handful of top-tier providers: Cloudflare, AWS, GoDaddy, Namecheap, or Oracle, which, as we know, was formerly Dyn, and a few others. So, for what it's worth, forewarned is forearmed. And being aware of this is the point. And after that, it's a judgment call. If anyone is in a truly mission-critical operation, I would argue that the added overhead of maintaining fully separate redundant DNS services is probably justified. If nothing else, choose two different big guys to host your common DNS. The amazing thing about the design of the DNS system back from day one is that it will automatically and transparently find and use a redundant DNS server. That part works really well. I've spent a lot of time looking at DNS. The whole DNS spoofability test basically induces the user's computer to send out lots of DNS queries. And so I've watched how the DNS server that was most recently used receives a single DNS query. If it doesn't respond within a relatively short time, all the DNS servers that are configured on a system are then sent a copy of that DNS query. So, if there's any stutter in the primary server, the secondary one, it responds. The system deals with it so quickly that the end user never has any idea. So that's, of course, over on the user side. Over on the corporate side, you want your sites to be hosted by well separated DNS, so that an outage in either still allows the whole system to continue. And again, if it doesn't, if you were down during that Dyn DNS day and all it meant was an unscheduled vacation, then okay.
You're not mission critical, clearly.
Yeah, maybe you don't care.
Right.
But if you're in charge of having a boss who absolutely wants you never to be down, it's just not that big a deal to set up a second DNS really somewhere else.
Yeah.
Because the system beautifully will really use it.
I'm pretty sure that's what we would do here, but I'd have to look more deep. We use DNS Simple, but I think we also use AWS, so we get both.
Yeah, I don't. I have both of my servers are, I'm at level 3, and they are, I don't know geographically if they're separate, but, I'm using 2 level 3 servers, so I'm not taking my own advice. On the other hand, if I had to have an unscheduled vacation day, okay.
So it was funny to hear you talk about Alexa as the website ranking company. I completely forgot about them.
Yeah, they're still around.
They're still around.
Yeah.
And for a while, I think I kind of didn't really trust their results because I think they were basing their measurements on you running an Alexa browser extension, that kind of thing. But they've, I think, come a long way since then. So
I remember in the very early days, it was Mark Thompson who put me onto them, and we used to compare our site rankings back in the day. Now it's like,
who cares?
Whatever.
Yeah, remember that was a big deal. You'd have a little button, you'd put it at the top 5% of the web or whatever it was on the bottom.
And of course, there was only 27 websites.
It's easy to
back
do then.
Not
Amazon
a big deal.
Bought them, and I guess that's where they got the name for their Echo Assistant. They figured, well, we already own it, so let's just use that. We don't have to worry about copyright. It's Amazon now, which means it probably is. They have a pretty good handle on web traffic, I would imagine.
All indications are Amazon is coming on really strong with their cloud offerings.
Yeah, they own the market. Really? Google and Microsoft and Apple and others are trying to get in that market, but there's nobody bigger than Amazon. They're really dominant.
Sure.
Mr. Gibson, once again, a fascinating look at the way things work on this island we call technology.
And how they break when they don't.
And how they break, which is a big part of it.
Or they don't when they break or something.
Yeah. They don't work when they break, and they break when they don't work. You'll find Steve's work at grc.com. That's his website, GRC, the Gibson Research Corporation. And he has lots of great stuff there, including his bread and butter, his one paid thing, which is SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. And now I'm going to say the world's best SSD maintenance and recovery utility, because you got some benefit just by being a, you know, hard drive tool. But now with these new features, this is really exciting. I think this is going to put you on.
You and I are going to look at the output of the benchmark.
Big breakthrough.
You're able to look at just the five numbers, or you can ask for four levels of granularity where it breaks it does a 1 gig transfer, and it breaks it down into individual transfers within the whole transfer. And it's really our listeners are going to go nuts.
I think you're going to have to change the name, though, to something like Doesn't Spin Right or something, because there's no spinning involved.
Sit right.
Sit there.
Squat right. I don't know.
Squat right, no. I'll veto that one right
now. No, it's
that.
Not good.
It's still called Spin Right for historical reasons.
It's going to be Spin Right. It's just got too much established rep.
Oh, I think you want people to understand that now it does something for SSDs that you just couldn't do. I mean, this is really exciting. I'm thrilled. Find out more, buy it. Why not? 6.0 is out.
Run on Macs too, by the way.
You figured that one out?
Yeah.
Recently? Is this a?
Well, it's got to be a Mac that still has the boot camp.
Support. Oh, yeah, that's yes.
And it's going to and also only Intel.
Yeah, you're going to have a whole new world of Macs out there that you're going to have to figure out.
Yep.
Well, that's 6.3 or 2 or 7.
Yeah.
6.0 is out now. You'll be getting 6.1 automatically, and you can participate in its development as well. GRC.com. That's also where you'll find 16 kilobit audio versions of this show. You'll also find handwritten transcripts by Elaine Ferris, so you can read along as you listen. And he's got the 64 kilobit audio for those of you with sensitive ears. That's GRC.com. We have 64 kilobit audio plus video at our website, twit.tv/SN. There's a YouTube channel devoted to security now. You can watch there. Best thing, subscribe. That way you'll get it automatically the minute it's available. You won't miss an episode. This is one show you do not want to miss an episode. We will be back as we always are Tuesday. Thanks to Jason Howell for filling in for me last week. He did a great job. I'll be back next week with Steve. We have our best of coming up later in the month. That's going to be a lot of fun. Tune in.
I'm going to be on the Christmas special with you guys.
Oh, I forgot. Yes. Yes, we decided to do OG Twits this year. So since, you know, normally we would like to fly you out and all that, we obviously aren't going to be doing that. Yeah. But it's going to be the OG Twits on our Twit holiday special. That'll be a lot of fun.
That's
can't wait
gonna
for that.
That's going to be a great group. Me, yeah. Paul, and Jeff.
Yeah, on the 20th. So make sure you make some time for that one. Okay, we do this show at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC every Tuesday. You can watch live, and I hope you will. Thank you, Steve.
Ciao.
Want more Twit? Check out Tech News Weekly, twit.tv/TNW. Tech News Weekly is a show where Jason Howell and I bring the latest and greatest interviews to you from the people making and breaking the tech news. twit.tv/TNW.
Security now.